When you're paid, leave you all alone, and nobody called you on the phone. Don't you feel?
This is the wailing voice of Betty Harris singing Cry to Me, produced by Burt Burns, the subject, in a way, of longtime San Francisco music critic Joel Selvin's latest book, Here Comes the Night, The Dark Soul of Burt Burns and the Dirty Business of Rhythm and Blues. I'm Suzanne Lang, and it's a novel idea. Doug Jane of KRCB's Connections program has a colorful conversation with Selvin about the patterned story of the darker side of the music business through the prism of music producer Burt Burns, who may be obscure to us now, but wouldn't be so if I rattled off a bunch of his hit songs. But I'll let Selvin do that for himself in just a minute. Later in the broadcast, I'll talk with Bello Miguel Cipriani, the author of Blind, a Memoir. And Rosemary Manchester is back from the road and tells us all about the Tucson Festival of Books. So stay with us. It's a novel idea. Joel Selvin was the music critic with the San Francisco Chronicle from 1972 until 2009, and has been writing about music, musicians, and the music industry since his college days in Riverside. He left there way before graduating with the goal of making some money writing. Here's Doug Jane in conversation with Joel Selvin on Here Comes the Night, The Dark Soul of Burt Burns and the Dirty Business of Rhythm and Blues.
Would you mind talking a little bit about where you grew up, how you grew up, and what kind of music was in your house and records and that kind of stuff?
I always try and avoid the phrase grew up, but I was raised in Berkeley. My father worked for labor unions as a press agent, but he was a big jazz fan. So I grew up around a lot of Count Basie, Fats Waller, and especially Duke Ellington. When I was 16, they started throwing concerts at the Fillmore, and I attended them regularly. And you know who I saw at the Fillmore in 1966, 67, 68. You know, growing up in the San Francisco Bay Area in the 60s, music was just a part of life, and it was a part of your culture. It was just blowing up in front of you. It was in the air. It was around the corner. A little band, Creedence Clearwater, playing at this bar. Jerry Garcia jamming with some keyboard player named Howard Wales at that bar. It was real.
And you went away to school, right? To lovely Riverside?
Is that right? I attended the University of California, Riverside, briefly. I spent most of my time hustling articles for the school newspaper out of Hollywood, interviewing people that you just wouldn't think they would give college student newspaper writers time with. Sly Stone, Little Richard, Alvin Lee, just tons of people.
While you were going to Riverside?
Yeah, so I really didn't, I wasn't very academically accomplished and gave up on that pretty quick to move up to San Francisco and try to sell newspaper articles about newspaper. But I dropped out of Berkeley High School in June of 1967, a little shy of graduation, and took a job that fall as a copy boy at the San Francisco Chronicle, $55 a week. And among the perks was you could get on the guest list at the Fillmore. So I sort of fell into this whole backstage life at an early age and immediately was smitten with the newspaper thing. The little adjunct of going to university was under the misassumption that I needed a college education to get a job at a newspaper. That was my goal. Chronicle, I started writing for the Chronicle in 1970, and by 1972 I had a staff position there. all my high school pals were still in college.
Who was the pop critic before you?
Ralph Gleason was the first person to cover pop music for any daily newspaper in the country. Started at the San Francisco Chronicle in 1950. And then in 1970, he retired from the Chronicle, went to work at Fantasy Records. He was going to produce movies, did that great movie, Rip Torn Payday. And John L. Wasserman took over the entertainment column that Ralph had pioneered. I think of John as having belonged to the Playboy generation, you know, cool jazz and hi-fi. And the rock thing just was beyond him. But he was smart enough to realize that there's a substantial audience for that, and he needed to represent it in the paper.
So you provided a service by being able to be willing to go to these shows and see them to listen to a rock album.
Every so often, John would say, I got to do this show, keep my credentials alive, he would say. So he goes to cover Led Zeppelin at the Oakland Coliseum, and he says in the column Monday morning, going to see Led Zeppelin reminded me of three things. And the first thing was a real long paragraph about how horrible concert sound is. And then the second one's a real long paragraph about what animals attend these events. And the third is just one sentence. It says, how indebted I am to my assistant, Joel Selvin.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Oh, it was great. And, you know, I think for a long time I wrote about this stuff in the paper, and the only people that even noticed were the other people like me that cared. I mean, certainly the guys running the paper didn't notice that I was reviewing all those rock shows at Winterland. But those of us who were going to the shows and that were part of that expanding rock culture at that time, we were tuned into that. Mm-hmm. That was a vital source of information. I was a big link in the chain, and I was glad to be there.
How much were you writing about concerts versus how much were you writing about albums?
Oh, in the first 15 years at the paper, I was out 4 to 6 nights a week and had 3 to 5 reviews in the paper. There was that much going on in the San Francisco nightclubs and concert scenes. It was just swinging, you know. Right. One night, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers would be at the Oakland Coliseum, and Bob Seger would be at the Cow Palace, and Prince would be coming out at some nightclub, and there'd be a really hot new band out at, the old Waldorf or something. I look back on my old clips sometimes, and I just go, wow, that really was swinging.
And the record companies and management companies seem to need critics, right? I mean, do they?
They didn't know what they needed. It reminds me of what Bobby Dale said about disc jockey conventions. You know, they found out I was third rated in the 27th market, so they gave me a dirty book and a towel. But there was a lot of lavish money available for record promotion in that era. Fleetwood Mac sold 14 million copies of Rumor in 1977, and they out-earned The Exorcist, which Warner Brothers also owned, and it was their big hit movie of that time. And the guys at Warner Brothers are sitting looking at what? We made more money on a record than a movie? So there was a very lavish period, and they really, their marketing arms became much more developed over the years, but at first they just didn't know what to do. So they threw money at radio, they threw money at press, they threw money at tour support. Crazy time.
You worked for the Chronicle until when? You retired 5 years ago?
'09. I left the Chronicle with 220 other editorial employees that year.
Wow.
I call it the class of '09.
Wow. Well, let's talk a little bit about Burt Burns. Let's start by telling everyone who Burt Burns is.
Well, I'll tell you, Doug, I may have found the last great untold rock and roll story. This man's name first came to my attention a long time ago, and I noted the records that he made had certain similar characteristics that resonated with me, and I started paying attention to it. And the more I paid attention to it, the more it opened up. And I came to learn the details of the man's life story. He was stricken with rheumatic fever at age 14. In 1945, that was a death sentence. There was no open-heart surgery. He was told he probably wouldn't live to be 21. He never went back to school. He pretty much gave up anything of discipline, just became a ne'er-do-well, played piano, and hung out at mambo parlors. At age 31, still alive, he gets into the record business. And within a year and a half, he's enormously successful, and he proceeds to propel himself to the very top ranks of the rhythm and blues world at the absolute height of New York's ascendancy in that world.
Can you give a little list of tunes?
He goes from a songwriter with a hit Little Bit of Soap by the Jar Mills to a producing a record for Atlantic Records with Solomon Burke, Cry to Me, and then producing a second version of a song he wrote called Twist and Shout that Phil Spector had screwed up the original version of, and he produced it with the Isley Brothers. That was a huge hit record. Then he became a staff producer for Atlantic. He saved there at a very dry period, pumped out hits by Solomon Burke, Drifters Under the Boardwalk, reestablished that franchise. At that point, his old songs are being recorded in England. Twist and Shout's a worldwide hit by some group called the Beatles. So he goes over to England, he produces a bunch of groups there, comes back the next year. He's given a group called Them with a singer named Van Morrison. He gives them one of his songs, Here Comes the Night. It's the number two hit in England. It establishes Them and makes Van Morrison.
And that Here Comes Tonight was one of the, that he wrote.
That's a Burke Aaron song. Yeah. Wow. He sat there in that studio on his acoustic guitar and played it for him.
And he recorded or wrote songs with different names too, right?
So his name was Bertrand Russell Burns, and there's a lot of Bert Russell songs. In the latter part of his career, he formed a partnership with Atlantic Records to start his own record label, Bang Records, by which time he'd become personally and professionally associated with members of the criminal underworld. And at some point, it became incumbent upon him to use those associations to negotiate with Atlantic Records. He scared the hell out of Neil Diamond, who was signed to his label, and threatened Van Morrison with these people. And then at the height of all this fury, he dropped dead at age 37 from the heart attack he'd been expecting since he was 14. It's a almost operatic story, and it's got so many details and little pieces in it because a lot of the narrative is tied to the ambitions of the owners of Atlantic Records and their efforts to try and sell the company while keeping it afloat.
I get the feeling that with those guys too, like with Ahmed and Jerry Wexler, because they lived so long, they were able to kind of rewrite their persona. The way their image was much softer, and perhaps maybe if Bert Burns would have lived to be 75 years old, you know, there might be a warm and fuzzy story about him.
Jerry Wexler was a very avuncular, warm, expansive guy. He could be very temperamental and fiercely proud and arrogant, but he was a charming guy to spend an evening with and do an interview. Did it many times. And Wexler did buff his reputation. The guy that I knew was not the guy who was described to me by the people I talked to for this book. They saw much more of a Sammy Glick, a very ambitious, lustful, temperamental, arrogant guy that didn't let anything get in the way of him getting what he wants. That's at odds with the picture that was painted of him as the sort of gray eminence that he was later in his life. And Ahmet, too, buffed his reputation. And I don't mean to say that these guys weren't both wonderful characters and made great contributions. It's just they take on a different form in the account.
Right, or any more than Bert was totally a whack guy, too, because he had a lot of people that spoke of him fondly, that they had good sessions with him, and he was very animated, I guess, and talked fast, but there was people that had good things to say about Bert Burns.
Bert Burns was a controversial character. I think people liked him a lot. He was warm and friendly. As he got more successful, he became more frantic, and he became more associated with these dark powers. There's beatings, there's threats, there's smoke bombings. It's an interesting kind of hero. The moral universe of the rhythm and blues world is something I go into great detail in the book. It is always an arena where mobsters operated on the periphery and not the edge, but Roulette Records was the front end of the syndicate. This has never really been written about or researched that much before, but in order to really set Burns' story in the precise moral universe, I go to great detail to try and explain how this whole rhythm and blues world operated. The book, in many ways, is as much a biography, for instance, of Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller as it is Burns. Burns' life and career is the framing device, without any question, and it drives the narrative. I'm looking at the work of Burt Bacharach and Phil Spector. Mm-hmm. The Atlantic Record guys are huge characters in this book. Lieber and Stoller, of course. And all these people interacted with Burns in important ways in business and musically. So it's an ensemble portrait in many ways.
Right. I think that it's great that you do get involved with talking about Atlantic Records and stuff, and you're kind of framing Burt's story around what's going on in the world of music at the time and not assuming that everyone's heard of Atlantic Records and knows what's going on. So you really are kind of putting the era in a context.
Well, it's a terribly dense and detailed book at some times. My editor, Charlie Winton, he said that Burns' life is a prism, is a lens for this subject. And I think that's accurate. Is he's got this very dramatic life story, and it wraps around this incredible moment in an art form that had been developing. Just at the time that all those incredible songwriting teams like Palmas and Schumann and Goffin and King and Mann and Wheel, Sadaka and Greenfield bloomed, and those incredible record producers, Bacharach and Spector and Lieber and Stoller, and Luther Dixon is a guy that's very underrated. All those people were just blossoming at the time that Burns was operating in the same offices and the same studios and using the same musicians.
You know, a lot of his really great songs are lesser-known ones, too. I was checking out a collection with some of the tunes, and some of the ones on here are not household names, but he has amazingly great songs. And the sound of them, the Phil Spector sound, which he kind of has that sound through all of his stuff, this is really kind of all over.
A lot of mambo in his thing. He was the king of Cuban rock and roll. The thing, Doug, that strikes me about Burns' music and always has is there's just this tremendous urgency to it. Just from the very first line, he's shoving his singers in corners, and they may not make literal sense, but he gets them pushed over to where they're right on the edge of hysteria, and this kind of dark energy pervades them. Even a song like, say, Cry to Me, which is essentially a love song, but it's all the content is all about being lonely and how terrible it is not being loved. And it's a song filled with despair, not happiness. So I tuned into that, and I find that element is a part, is just pervades his music. And I associate that with his doomed life, that when other songwriters can make up songs employing all the cliches around similes and metaphors with hearts, when Burt Burns writes "Take It, Take Another Little Piece of My Heart," he's writing his own pathology.
I want to ask you about what it's like to write a book about someone that you never met versus someone like Rick Nelson. When you talk about Rick Nelson as a young boy, we all see him in our brain. And when you talk about Burt Burns at all, we don't see them. I mean, the folks listening right now don't know what he looks like. Run over to Google and take a look at Burt Burns.
Is the cover photograph great?
It is so great. And, of course, he's got the bad ticker, but what's he got hanging from his mouth?
Shades, cigarette, his acoustic guitar. That's the guitar he wrote Twist and Shout on. He only owned one guitar his life. I've held that guitar in my hands and strummed it.
Ah, wow.
So
what is it, a Goya?
A Goya, yeah. It's a cheap guitar. Yeah. But a lot of songs in that cheap guitar. So I wrote a book about Sly Stone. It was an oral history, and I never met him. I had met him in the past. But the thing about Sly Stone was when you talked to somebody who had met him and interacted with him, they remembered it so vividly. Oh, yeah, Sly walked in, you know, and they, mm-hmm. and when I was talking to people about these recording sessions or these encounters or their careers, it had been such a workaday world for those people. It was unremarkable in many ways. Artie Butler, who was the great arranger that did so many of these records, he did Cherry Cherry, he did What a Wonderful World. He was a brilliant musician, and his name is on a lot of small print. He says, geez, Joel, I don't know. It's like trying to remember wallpaper you hung 40 years ago.
Right.
So this was a very interesting world to try and penetrate and recreate because it was so evanescent. It lasted so briefly.
Tell me about more songs. Getting more stories.
Like these stories?
Yeah.
Ask me about Under the Boardwalk.
Tell us about Under the Boardwalk, Joel.
So Under the Boardwalk was a song that Wexler wanted the Drifters to record. Burns didn't really care for it that much. He had a song he wrote called I Don't Want to Go On Without You that he liked as the...
And who wrote Under the Boardwalk?
It was a song team called by Artie Resnick and Kenny Young. They were out of Trinity Music, TM Music, TM Music. Okay. Real building song. They hadn't had a hit before. And so I Don't Want to Go On Without You, Bert routined with baritone singer Charlie Thomas. Rudy Lewis was going to sing Under the Boardwalk. The morning of the session, Rudy Lewis woke up dead, died of a drug overdose in his bed in his hotel room. Charlie Thomas had to stop by on the way to the session and close the dead man's eyes. Wexler didn't want to cancel the session. So, changed a couple keys, cut a couple extra tracks. Now Johnny Moore's the lead vocalist on Under the Boardwalk. They knock that out real quick. And then they bring on Charlie Thomas to sing I Don't Want to Go On Without You. Suddenly, this song has a completely different meaning.
I want to ask you also about collaborating, writing books, because you've done, you collaborated with Sammy Hagar,
mm-hmm.
right? You collaborated with Ed Hardy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that actually like being a co-writer and a co-artist with someone, or are you more like the producer and kind of directing them? So
if I'm writing a book like Sammy Hagar's autobiography or Ed Hardy's autobiography, my job is to be entirely transparent and give the reader the experience of having Ed or Sammy tell them their story. These guys aren't illiterate, but they're not writers. We conduct long tape-recorded interviews, I get the transcripts, and I work with the transcripts until I've got them to tell their story in their voice. I love these things.
Yeah, it sounds great. You got more coming up?
I'm working with a record producer named L.A. Reed, who is responsible for Mariah Carey's comeback, the whole L.A. face thing of the 90s, TLC, Outkast, Justin Bieber was one of his discoveries.
Oh.
So he's a real interesting guy. He was a drummer from Cincinnati that is now running Epic Records, and he's got a great career, and he's got a great story, and he's got a great voice, and I'm really excited about
it. Tell me about the play of Burt Burns.
There's a musical. It's going into previews at the Signature Theater in New York on June 21st. It's called Peace of My Heart. And it leans very heavily on the doomed heart and the gangster angle. Plus, it has the adult daughter who doesn't remember her father. Because Burns had three children that mm-hmm. don't remember him. They were all under 3 years old when he died. The adult daughter trying to discover her father and reconcile with her mother. So it's got all these kind of like story elements going. And the music, what do you know, it fits like jigsaw pieces. I went to a reading of this, and Jerry Ragavoy, who was a Burns song collaborator, wrote Peace of My Heart with Burns and Cry Baby and worked with Burt all his life, was sitting in front of me. And the final three songs are almost melodramatic. And I sat behind Jerry Ragavoy as he took off his glasses and with one hand conducted the band through these last three songs, two of which he was a writer of, and the other hand he wiped tears out of his eyes.
Wow.
Quite a moment. Sissy Houston was there. She was like blown away by the whole thing. I think it's going to be a very surprising musical. Nobody's expecting this kind of story out of this music.
People seem ready to be swept up by stories of people they don't know. I'm thinking of the Rodriguez thing that happened.
Doug, so I took this book to every major publisher in New York, and the answer was always the same. It says, nobody's heard of this guy. Now the book's coming out, and the reaction I'm hearing at this point is, wow, nobody's heard of this guy. So You never know what to say about conventional wisdom. I guess it's like military intelligence and jumbo shrimp, right?
Well, it is so weird that he has all these songs that are just so famous. They're just, I mean, once you hear them, you just know, you know the song, but you don't think of him. Going back to Phil Spector, his sound is so overwhelming that when you hear a Phil Spector song, you don't think, oh, it's the Crystals. Oh, that's Darlene Love or whoever. You just know it's a Phil Spector thing, where I think because his stuff was a little more diverse and, you know, he seemed to make his arrangements for the song. They didn't have necessarily quite the sound that...
Oh, there's a Burt Burns sound. I'll tell you what it is, okay? Think about Phil Spector's record with the Righteous Brothers, You've Lost That Loving Feeling. You know that record very well, I'm mm-hmm. sure. Think about the breakdown where the two voices go, yeah, yeah. Do you really know what's going on underneath that? Doom, 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 mm-hmm. doom, 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 doom. Tribute to Burt Burns.
Okay.
It's not just a lick. He's got a certain kind of Baroque approach to the R&B sound. It's most evident on the Solomon Burke records. The Hoagie Land single, wow, that's a lost gem. And that's got that sound. There's records that are a little bit more Afro-Cuban, like the original version of My Girl Sloopy by the Vibrations. And there's stuff that's more suited towards like the British rock idiom of the mid-60s, like Here Comes the Night or I Want Candy by the Strangeloves. And then has got more further into the world of soul music as opposed to R&B. There's some interesting pieces with like Wilson Pickett, Come Home Baby, a Man in Wheels song, kind of a in between the R&B era and the soul era. And then firmly in the soul era, number one R&B record from 1966, Are You Lonely For Me, Baby by Freddie Scott. Mm-hmm. Very much in the Stax Volt Memphis soul bag.
What you were saying about how the music will get kind of a groove, and then the vocals almost sounded like they were recorded too hot. Like the music is just grooving at a nice level and everything, and the vocals are just really pushing it. And the background vocals are singing one thing, and then the lead vocals kind of comping over it, and really, really, really great.
Burns records are all about voices. He wants those singers just up front and in your face and sounding very desperate. Cry to Me by Betty Harris, 19-year-old girl, never been in the recording studio together. And he just pulls this vocal performance out of her. It's chilling.
So the story's not over, though. You're still talking about the book. The book's coming out today, right? Is today the
next week
date for the book?
Well, you know, April 15th. Yeah, this has been an extraordinary experience for me, Doug. As a writer, as a journalist, you know, whatever the hell I've done professionally.
You know, just having everyone know who he is awesome. Good job, man.
Thank you, Doug. I'm so glad to be up here.
So glad you came in. Good luck with the book. Good luck with the book tour. And you're going to be at the grand opening of the Piece of My Heart when it opens on Broadway or wherever it's going
to
open?
I would miss it. And we're going back to do some work with the book. April 22nd at the Bitter End, we're going to do a Burt Burns book party with special music appearances by Benny King, Brenda Reed of the Exciters, and Betty Harris, along with some cast members from the musical. So we're going to have a little splash in New York, and then we're going to be back to take on Broadway. And there's a documentary film in the works, and we're hearing from movie producers, and yeah, you know.
A hit. You're going to have a hit.
Your lips, God's ears, babe. You know, Doug, it's just been fantastic over the years to witness all the contributions you've made up here in the North Bay to the music scene. I don't know how many people have been so many different things, record store owner, recording artist, concert producer, radio broadcaster. I admire your work and
thanks.
Opportunity well, to nice. Express that admiration.
Appreciate it.
Going past.
Well, we're both pretty lucky to be able to make a living in the music business.
Oh, man, it's like not working at all.
Just like that.
Doug Jane and Joel Selvin. You're listening to KRCB's A Novel Idea. I'm Suzanne Lang, and we'll be right back with Bello Cipriani and Rosemary Manchester. Here's Dusty Springfield and a Burt Burns classic.
you feel like you were the only man. And I give you everything a woman possibly can.
Bello Cipriani grew up in East San Jose before making his way to the sophistication of the city and the pace of the Castro. A brutal assault by some old friends, no less, resulted in the loss of his sight. With humor and candor, Bello Cipriani chronicles the first 2 years of his emergence into his new life as a blind person. We explore his transition from being housebound after the injury to a world traveler, public speaker, subject of films, and spokesperson for Guide Dogs for the Blind. Here's my conversation with Bello Miguel Cipriani.
The book starts out with an assault on you, a betrayal, an injury that results in your blindness. And in some ways, it starts out with an assault for the readers as well. You hit us right away with that episode and incident in your life that caused your blindness.
Yes.
That must have been difficult to write about, but the undercurrent of that assault and betrayal for the reader stays with us, as it stayed with you during those especially that first year of adjustment. And how did you decide to bring us into your life that directly?
You know, I started writing relatively soon after the assault. So the assault happened in 2007, maybe about a year later, as I was being trained at the Orientational Center for the Blind in Albany, California. As I learned to navigate this new piece of equipment and software, I started to just record things through voice and through text, and it almost started like a diary. And so these are just the things that I had to talk about. It was part therapeutic, part art. And I feel that it was very good that I did that then, because I felt that was what allowed me to expel all these emotions that were maybe holding me back. And also it allowed me to focus and reflect. And so, you know, initially, a lot of when I started collecting these short essays, a lot of them were more of diary entries. There's a chapter specifically that stands out to me in the book that's called Quack. And that actually was written as I was experiencing all those items that I mentioned. So a lot of the book is, you know, was written right as the things were happening, as I was learning to become independent, you know, again, through mobility, through software, through, you know, learning to read again. And so I think that allowed me to just focus on what I was feeling at the time, and it made things much easier. I look back at the book now and I say, wow, I'm glad that I did this then, because I would have probably forgotten how hard this was.
The way you bring us into the story is very direct and straightforward. The book is not what I'm going to say emotional, or isn't even that it elicits sympathy as much as it brings us directly into your experience of learning, of being an independent person and regaining that independence in perhaps ways that were very unexpected to you.
Absolutely. I feel that, yeah, I've always been an avid reader, and when I lost my sight, I immersed myself in books about blind people. And I felt that a lot of these books focused on, you know, these wonderful things that these blind people have done, and you forget the day-to-day things. You don't know those things, you know. And I think that's when sighted people think about blind people, that's probably what they're most curious about. You know, how do we dress ourselves? How do we do certain things? How do we read our mail, our snail mail? And for that reason, I wanted to be informative. And so I focused on, you know, just, like I said, the day-to-day mundane things that are part of a blind person's life. And I felt that, you know, I wanted this to be informative, not just my story, but also I want people to understand, you know, what it's like to be a blind person in, you know, the 21st century.
And I think that your personality of, I mean, I've only just met you, but I've read your book, and your kind of natural sassiness or, really comes through throughout. And that, I think, helps disarm the reader and open up the experience like, oh, this is, you know, and he cares about his hair.
Yeah, you know, well, you know, I grew up with... one of five children, and I have four sisters. So I kind of grew up in, you know, and we're already close in age. So fighting for the bathroom, you know, is, you know, kind of you stand up for yourself or you, you know, get eaten in the pack, sort of speaks. So I think that's where a lot of my, you know, my sassiness comes from. I think also, you know, being a gay man and being gay in a time where it was very hard, you know, they refer to it as the gay 90s, but, you know, I was out in high school and it was tough. You know, you don't hear many stories about that. And so I felt that I always had this defense, you know, mechanism as someone who was out and gay in the 90s. And so, yeah, I think that my eyesight changed. I didn't change.
Let's talk about that. You were a young gay man, a young gay teenager, and were experimenting or going to clubs with friends and forging your identity as a young gay man. Before your injury that resulted in your blindness happened, what was the trajectory you were on at that time?
I was working in staffing, and I was working as a consultant for various companies. I helped staff all the big names in Silicon Valley. I've helped, you know, companies like Google, Hitachi, eBay, and Lucasfilms. And at that time, my goal was just to move up the ladder into management, being an executive at some point, whether it was a consulting company or in-house other corporation. That's where I was being groomed. When I lost my sight, I actually went back to the same work I was doing before, with an agency, and I do talk about this in the book, and I did get laid off from the company, but since then, I had multiple offers to return to the corporate world, and it's just, I lost the fire in my belly. It just doesn't appeal to me anymore. You know, I'm a full-time writer now. I'm the writer in residence at Holy Names University in Oakland, California, and I get to teach also, and it's just, you know, open up this world that's very rewarding for me.
After you lost your sight and re-entered the workplace, you encountered many of the same people you had worked with before. And that must have been an unusual experience for them and for you to not see you in a while, and then when they encounter you again, you're blind.
Yeah, and it still happens. You know, every time I go through the financial district, I sometimes meet people who say, "Hey, are you related to Bella Cipriani?" Because they can't believe it's me because, you know, they didn't know me as a blind person. And so I get a chuckle. It's, you know, it must be just as hard if it was for me as, you know, as it is for some of these people to see me as a different person. They don't know, you know, what I can do or what I'm able to provide, or they don't know how sensitive I am, or they don't know where I'm at, you know, and my grief of, you know, my vision loss. And so I think that initially it was tough for some people. And I had some people tell me that it was really hard for them. I had some people tell me it was no big deal. So, you know, you get the whole gamut.
It seems like you were even sometimes getting tired of people asking you.
You know, when you're, especially, this happened to me a lot in San Francisco, on public transport, whether it was Muni or in a cab, it's, everybody wants to know if I was born blind or if I became blind later in life. And to me, that was very personal. And I used to really bothered me, you know. And sometimes just to, you know, if I wasn't in the mood to talk, I would just say, yes, I was. I was born blind, and end of it, right? But I think now, well, since my book has come out, I've been obviously more open to talking about it. And I'm able to just really touch on the details that people want to know. Yes, I lost my sight. I was in my 20s. And yes, I was rehabilitated. And yes, there's life after disability. And this, I actually find my life a lot more rewarding now than when I had a vision.
I was surprised at how many other adults lose their vision after having vision, either through disease or injury, gunshot.
The number is really big. 60 million Americans are at risk of vision loss, which is just, you know, a huge number. And a lot of these is, you know, diabetes. It's a big, big contributor to blindness.
I was really surprised how many of the people you met who became blind through diabetes.
It's a major contributor to blindness now.
So in your life, your blindness came about, as some others did in your book as well, through an act of violence.
Mm-hmm.
So you were not only dealing with having to learn everything new, but you were having to deal with the emotional, the anger, the betrayal that you felt as a young man.
Definitely. And I actually have forgiven the people who attacked me. It didn't happen in the time discussed in the book, but it did happen shortly after. And I think that one of the reasons why I was able to forgive these people and move on was to have all these people in similar situations to talk to. For instance, at the center that you described, there was other people who were headshot victims, you know, and we talked about, you know, our attackers. And I think that was very empowering for me.
The period of time described in the book is one of your learning how to even just get out of your apartment.
Yes.
And decide what you're going to wear, and mm-hmm. and travel around. And it seems like you were surprised that you could do this. Like, at one point you say, oh, it is a lot easier walking with a cane.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things that as I gained independence through, you know, picking up these new skills as a blind person, it was a very unique experience in a sense, and very positive that I could do something on my own. And it was very shocking. You know, how I could describe it is that, you know, I was told, yes, if you learn your cane skills, you would do this and this A and B. But to actually do it and do it as they described it was just really bizarre to me. And I think that's just because that hadn't happened to me before. You know, I went to college and people explained life, right? This is going to happen. And most of the time that it wasn't true, versus with blindness, there is a science to it. You know, and I think that's something that I was discovering in this book, that there is a science to being blind. There's nothing magical. You know, every time I do something, you know, for example, if I'm crossing the street, because of the sewer system, it kind of hikes up, right? It's like a bridge. And I could tell when I'm about to hit the curb because it kind of dips down again. And I could tell people, oh, the curb's coming up. Oh my God, that you're magical. Or you're, you know, and it's not. It's a science. I was taught that. That's how the sewer system, the streets in San Francisco work. And so I think that it was part of that, being able to, you know, depend on the science, that was effective.
It also seems that there is a, and maybe this is part of the science you're talking about, a perception, a sensory perceptions that as a sighted person, we maybe take for granted or are underdeveloped and underexploited.
Absolutely. Even, you know, for example, I picked up a coin, you know, this morning, and I was like, this is a dime. My friend, oh my God, how do you know that? Well, because the dimes have grooves and pennies don't. And, you know, this is a woman, you know, middle age, and she had never paid attention to that her whole life. And so definitely, I think that once we start tapping into our other senses, you know, whether it's hearing, touch, smell, you start noticing things that go unnoticed by, you know, because of vision. Vision is very distracting.
In the book, you even talk about being like a superhero.
There's definitely an aspect of that. And I think that, you know, often what people know about blindness is limited to literature and movies in Hollywood. And that's very erroneous half the time. And, you know, we all know Daredevil, you know, we all know these different figures in the world that, you know, are blind, and we tend to sometimes romanticize them. So there's definitely a superhero aspect. And even I myself, I grew up reading comics, and I really thought I would get bionic hearing, and it didn't happen. I'm sad to report it didn't happen, but my sense of smell really, you know, sprung up. It changed. Where I had to change my deodorant, and my own deodorant made me sick. Well, that's a horrible smell. And so you know, again, there's definitely, like you said, a superhero aspect of it. And I think it's just, you know, when you exercise a sense, it just becomes very powerful.
You also, in the book, went through a transformation with regard to incorporating a dog, a seeing eye dog, into your life. It seems like at first, oh, dog hair, dog doo-doo, it seemed you couldn't imagine yourself. But once you went in that direction, it was, it seems like it was a huge leap in redefining yourself.
Absolutely. You know, and it's very common, you know, I meet other blind people and they all tell me that their first dog was their own guide dog. And that's very powerful because it's a symbol of, you know, how well trained these animals are, you know, that they don't act like regular dogs. And second of all is that, you know, how once you're put in a situation, you just adapt. I had never had a dog before. And, you know, one of the things that was very enticing about the guide dog lifestyle was that I could move so much faster. I could walk like I did when I had vision. But one of the most amazing things about having a service dog is that the public approaches you with gusto. And it's a lot different than when you have a cane, because with a cane, they usually approach you with fear or with concern. That's not the case with the dog. So those two things I felt were motivators for me to get a guide dog. And it was absolutely the best decision I ever made. You know, I just retired Matt a couple of months ago, who's the guide dog described in Blind. And today I'm here with my new guide dog, Oslo, who is nothing like Madge. He's twice as big, and he's a black lab, and he's just as wonderful.
How did you know or decide it was time to retire Madge?
Madge was 8 years old, and around eight and nine, they start slowing down. And she was just getting a little nervous when I was in airport travel, and, you know, she just seemed a little hesitant. She didn't have the same spunk she had when she was navigating, you know, BART or Muni. And you just notice their behavior change. You build this bond that's so strong that you just read them, and you could just feel that they're slowing down. And it was very challenging, but, you know, I have this new guide dog, and I think what I got out of this experience, which was very tough to retire your first guide dog and go to a second one, was that it's always possible to love and trust a second time.
I never met Madge, but I'm getting all choked up over here just because, really, because maybe I'm vicariously experiencing the sadness of giving up that dog, but I imagine that she is a wonderful dog in somebody else's life right now.
My sister adopted her.
Oh, how wonderful.
And my sister lives in Minneapolis. She has this huge 3-acre property in the outskirts of Minneapolis, and Madge is very happy. She actually had a big party that made the local newspapers. The university where I'm at, Holy Names, threw her a retirement party, and the media came. And it was very, very, very touching to see, you know, all these people come and pay their dues to Matt. And she had a great, great, you know, career. And I did this stat sheet of, you know, her life to present as a talk. And, you know, she went to 27 states and, you know, four countries, and she went to Europe, and she had a very full life. So
that means that she went there with you.
Correct.
And that you have moved from being a person who couldn't get out of your apartment easily to a world traveler.
Yes, you know, and I'm very, very fortunate that, you know, my book hasn't just touched the blind community, but it's touched people in different ways. And it's a lot of schools are using it as curriculum. And so it's offered me the opportunity to go guest lecture. I was a guest lecturer at Yale University about a year ago. And that's how I ended up at Holy Names University, was for the same reason. And so it's been just a magnificent journey that this book has, you know, put me on. And yeah, I took a couple months off to, you know, go train with Oslo. But things are going well. I feel very fortunate.
One thing I wanted to talk about also, because you talk about it in the book, is mm-hmm. your life as a gay man. Well, it sounds like you just jumped right back into regaining your life or your stride or your desire to be out there and mm-hmm. meeting people, and that it even seemed like you were maybe even surprised, oh, there are other gay blind men.
Exactly. There's actually an organization, it's called BPI, Blind Pride International. These are blind LGBT people around the world, and it was shocking when I learned about the organization, but then I took a step back and I said, of course there is. I mean, I just discovered so many. What I've also learned later, and I do talk about this in the book, is that, you know, a lot of men lose their vision through HIV. Mm. And that's something that was news to me, but it's very common. And I've met quite a few people who that was their cause of blindness. And so it explains why there's a big LGBT blind population. I've met quite a few. And, you know, I think it also was I was very lucky to be in the Bay Area, where, you know, there's such a very huge and strong LGBT community. I'm very open about my sexuality, just because as blind people in general, we're often depicted as being inspirational or being, you know, our disabilities are our identifier. And so what that does, it makes us just very one-dimensional. It makes us caricatures. And so once you've realized that, you know, he's a person who's blind, but he's also gay, and, you know, he's also, you know, a writer, and it gives layers to the person. And so one of the reasons why I'm very open about my sexuality is that it allows people to realize that, you know, gay people, I mean, blind people are very diverse.
And I think sometimes we tend to, as you say, make people who are either in a wheelchair or blind or have some sort of handicap or disability one-dimensional and desexualize them.
Absolutely. I talk about this, that, you know, a lot of my writing, the writing that I'm doing now about, you know, being de-eroticized.
There's something I wanted to talk to you about.
Sure.
That's in the book, and that... But you're going to have to pronounce this for me, the Brazilian...
capoeira.
You talk about that early in the book, that's an activity that you were very involved with before mm-hmm. you lost your sight. And, of course, I had to look it up immediately and then probably watched an hour worth of YouTube videos. And I had seen it before, but never really knew it was such a big movement. And first of all, for our listeners, why don't you describe what it is?
Sure. So I practice capoeira, which is an Afro-Brazilian martial art. It's the national sport in Brazil. And it's a form of a fighting form that was developed by African slaves during the colonial period, the slavery period in Brazil, and it was disguised as a dance so they could practice this powerful fighting technique, and the Portuguese slave masters wouldn't know what they were doing. And so it's very acrobatic. You basically, for those of you who train martial arts, our base is always moving, and so that's what gives it the appearance like you're dancing. When Brazilians started immigrating to New York and started doing capoeira on the street, that's where breakdancing came from. They started imitating the capoeira moves. So that's the origin of breakdancing, is they would try to imitate the capoeira movements. And I train in Berkeley with Mestre Accordeon, and I'm one of very few blind capoeira players in the world. I've met just about a handful, and it's believed that I'm the highest belted capoeira player in the country, actually. And it's something that I do for, you know, I do not just to keep in shape, but I think it's great fun. And it took me a while, like I mentioned in the book, to find an instructor who would take a chance on me, just because a lot of them felt that it could be done. Capoeira is done to live music, singing and drumming. And so a lot of the instructors feared that I would not be able to hear the movements. But, you know, I found an instructor who developed this technique to train me, and I'm, you know, a part of the Capoeira Academy just like anyone else's. And there's actually a documentary about my capoeira training on YouTube. It's called Capoeira in the Dark.
Wonderful, wonderful. Even though when you were sighted, early in the book, you talk about essentially getting kicked in the face.
Absolutely.
It didn't seem to prevent, having sight didn't prevent you from getting kicked in the face then.
Yeah.
But just for our listeners, it is a lot of leg movement, a lot of flipping about, twirling about. I mean, there are people who twirl around on their heads, and like you say, very similar, or break dancing. And so that is something you're doing now, and I'm going to go look for the YouTube video, because first of all, if you haven't seen it or seen people doing this, it's really quite beautiful and edgy to watch, and amazing people of all sizes and shapes doing it, and it looks like the healthiest thing one could do for keeping mobility as well. You must be limber to do this.
It's a great workout. Yeah, you know, I'm in my mid-30s now, so I'm not doing as many backflips as I used to, but I'm still able to, you know, walk on my hands, and, you know, it's a great community, just because, you know, sometimes I don't feel like, you know, doing the whole workout, so I could just drum or sing. So there's different ways to be a part of, you know, the capoeira circle.
And Bello, your memoir, Blind, a Memoir, seems to me like it is your story of going from the isolation of losing your sight to emerging into these incredible communities of people, of the blind, sighted, in a way that maybe you're destined to, just by your very nature, to not be isolated.
You know, once I became blind, I became part of all these communities that are so, so rich and involved. And, you know, a big example of that is the guide dog community. You know, there's guide dog cruises. There's Guide Dogs for the Blind has an alumni organization. They have all these trips, and you know, just there's all these ways to be active and be social. You know, you're right. You know, I'm part of all these communities, and I'm not sure if I would be part of all these communities have I not lost my sight. Probably not.
Well, I thank you for being here with us today. And I did want, you mentioned to me earlier that you are a spokesperson for the Guide Dogs for the Blind.
I am, yeah, a spokesperson for Guide Dogs for the Blind. And Oslo and I are featured in their new documentary. The documentary is called Harnessing the Power of Partnership. And you could go check it out, guidedogs.com. And it's a 5-minute short film about my story and how the agency changed my life, and, you know, just going over what the agency does. And, you know, it's Guide Dogs, you know, it's here in Marin, and people know its name, but they don't always know that it's the biggest guide dog school in the country, and that it's solely supported by donors. We don't receive any government funding. So all these great things that, you know, that are part of this film, all these informations that people may not know about. So I encourage everyone to check it out at guidedogs.com.
And of course, if you go down to San Rafael, you can see guide dogs being trained all over the city. And I imagine that when you went through your training, that's where you trained as well.
I did. I did both my trainings with my first and my second guide in San Rafael.
And of course, here in Santa Rosa, we have the Earl Baum Center.
Yes.
Well, Bello, is there anything you'd like to leave us with?
Just about blindness in general, I just want to leave your audience with, you know, blind people, before anything else, are people. And no two people have the same needs. So, you know, it's important just to keep in mind that one blind person may want to be treated differently than others, and we're all just people.
When we met this morning, I wasn't sure how to react or relate. I don't encounter many blind people in my day-to-day life. But what advice can you give to somebody like me who it's like, I don't want to be awkward. I don't want to be condescending or patronizing.
Well, I would just ask, how can I help you?
Yes.
And that's all. Blind people have various skill levels, education levels, ages, mobility. And so you just got to ask them how they want to be helped. And it's just kind of goes back to the person, the individual. You know, no two people have the same needs. So I think just asking the person. And it happens to me too. You know, I do a lot of disability conferences, and sometimes I meet people with a disability I'm not familiar with. And all I just got to do is ask, is this okay? What else can I do? And they understand that I'm just green.
And it maybe is just a good practice for all of us to exhibit a little bit more candor with each other, and that will take us a long way.
Absolutely.
Yes. Well, thank you for coming in today.
And, thank you.
Very great meeting you and your lovely dog, Oslo.
Bello Cipriani. Finally, Rosemary Manchester is excited about books. That goes without saying, but she's really excited about the Tucson Festival of Books.
Recently, I celebrated the Ides of March by going to the Tucson Festival of Books. This was my third year to go to the Tucson Festival. It's the fourth largest festival in the country. There were 450 writers and presenters there, and thousands of readers. It's held on the campus of the University of Arizona. And those of you who are familiar with the University of Arizona know that there's a long mall that goes down the very center of the campus. And the Festival of Books stretched on that mall from the Student Union building on the west to the science buildings on the east. It seemed to me that it was a mile long because I walked back and forth so many times, but that may be a little stretch of the imagination. The press said that there were 120,000 people there, and I think that's a conservative estimate because you could hardly make your way through the crowd. And the crowd was wonderful. There were little old ladies like me clutching their tote bags. There were people of all nationalities. There were families pushing strollers, little children running around with balloons. The whole thing was just a marvelous thing to be a part of. And you know, people say, nobody reads anymore. Not so. The whole event is very, very well organized, and hundreds of volunteers who really know their stuff and are enjoying themselves most of the time and can easily direct you to where you want to go. The two biggest venues that are used at the festival are the ballrooms in the Student Union, and they hold a lot of people. But they didn't hold everybody who wanted to hear Sandra Day O'Connor. And I was one of the people who didn't get to hear her. The line was an hour and a half long by the time I got there. And I knew that if I stood in that line, I wouldn't get in. I was really sorry not to hear her. I talked to a lot of people who did hear her, and they were simply in awe. One of the biggest names for me was Richard Russo. I've followed his work ever since he wrote Empire Falls. That was quite a while ago. And I remember being in a bookstore, in the Tidewater Bookstore in Damariscotta, of Maine, and over by the door, behind a table, sat an author with a little sign saying Richard Russo and buy his book Empire Falls, and nobody was talking to him. And it's one of the greatest regrets of my life that I didn't go over and talk to him. I thought I was too busy or something. And then to think that the heights of fame to which he rose and that wonderful, wonderful book, Empire Falls. So I did get into the ballroom to hear him. I stood in line for more than an hour, and I was literally sitting at his feet. He was on the stage, and I was in the front row. So I was adoring Richard Russo. He's written a memoir about his mother, and I just can't wait to get down to Copperfields and get a copy of it for myself, because he talked about it with such sensitivity, and he left a lot of questions unanswered so that we'd all really want to read the book. But there were other very important names as well. Rebecca Eaton, who's, I believe, the producer of Downton Abbey, and all the Downton Abbey folk, of which I am one, most of them were following her around. And the books are there for sale. It's very well organized, so you can buy the book and go to where the author is and have the author sign it. And that's always a good feature, you know, of a book festival. There were a lot of specialties represented. Some of them were interesting to me, and some of them were not, but they were all of interest to somebody. The science department of the university is very, very heavily featured in the book festival, and they had wonderful stuff going on at that end of the mall, but I didn't get down there enough to really be able to give you a good review of what was going on there, except people were having the best time. One of the authors who were, I'd never heard of this man, but I went to his presentation because he was going to talk about going down the Colorado River through the Grand Canyon. And since I had done that within the last 10 years, I was just, here's a new book about it. His name is Kevin Fedarko, and his book is The Emerald Mile, A Harrowing Trip Down the Colorado River. Well, the audience assembled. He was up front. He was introduced. And one of the first things he said was, "How many of you have made the trip down the Colorado River?" And I swear, everyone in that room raised a hand. So then he went to, "How many times have you done it?" And I think the last person standing had done it either 6 or 8 times. So he was in a room full of fanatics. And it was exhilarating to hear him talk about his journeys down the Colorado, and his he was very funny. Of course, when you get started, they don't give you the oars and say, "Row this boat." You get the much more menial chores, and he was very, very funny about those menial chores. An interesting thing, I always wonder how many people buy the book. I lined up to buy that book, and by the time I got to the counter, it was sold out. They'd had sent to the warehouse for more copies, but I wouldn't be surprised if there were other authors who had that same experience. I want to mention a few other names of people that I did get to hear. Anne Hillerman, Tony Hillerman's daughter, the late Tony Hillerman of the mystery set in New Mexico and Arizona, is carrying on her father's work. And she was there to talk about her book, Spider Woman. If that isn't the exact title, it's pretty close. And I had read the book. I'd gotten my hands on a copy of it early on. And so I was already a fan, because she not only had taken the storyline on and the characters, she'd given a little more prominent role to one of the women in the plot that I thought wasn't quite getting her due. And so Anne talked about how she did that. And she was very well received. There were a lot of people there who were just overjoyed that the Hillerman legacy will go on. Another writer I heard who impressed me a great deal was Valerie Plame. You remember, she was the CIA officer who was outed by Scooter Libby, and you remember all that foo-fara. She's marvelous. In the first place, she's so beautiful, you can hardly take your eyes off her. She was on a panel, And she was talking about what she's writing presently. Spy novels, of course. But in addition to that, she's writing a restaurant column in Santa Fe, where she lives. And she seemed very happy with her new life. And when was asked things that she couldn't answer, she said, "I'm sorry, I can't answer that question yet." So it was just a delight to hear her. Since there were so many authors, many of them were on panels of three writers who had a great deal in common. Sometimes those just simply don't work, you know, and they fall flat. But these panels were so well organized, and the people who were chairing them were so good, that it was really a group effort of several people working together in, on the same subject matter. I hope I've gotten you enthusiastic about the Tucson Festival of Books. You can go to their website, Tucson Festival of Books, and see a wonderful slideshow of pictures from this most recent festival. And I think you'll kind of catch the flavor of it. I didn't even talk about the culinary arts tent where Andrew Weil held forth. And of course, there were people certainly following in his train. You know, we've been so sad that the Sonoma County Book Festival is not going to be held this year. And I thought, what makes the Tucson Festival of Books work where ours has had to take a little time off? First of all, I think it's a question of scale. It's a large place, a lot of people who are donating huge sums of money to get the thing going and to fund it. And then they have the support of the university, and they have the support of the community. The newspaper is one of the sponsors. So they have a lot going for them that I think maybe our community is too small to muster that kind of support. But I do hope that the people who will miss having the book festival we'll put some effort into bringing it back next year, and that there will be kind of a groundswell of people who say, you know, I really miss the book festival. Let's get it going again, because we can do this.
Thank you, Rosemary Manchester. Rosemary is back next time, and I hope you'll be back next time, too. Doug Jane is the regular host of KRCB's Connections program, which you can hear Wednesdays at 7 here on KRCB. We've had production assistance today from Sean Knight. You can subscribe to our podcasts at krcb.org and listen to us through iTunes. I'm Suzanne Lang. Thanks for listening. It's a novel idea.